you know, and that's part of the kinship values that it's already instilled in us as Indigenous people, is that clanship is like, we say it, didn't they? But those aunties coming in and helping, those grandmothers taking that role. And we talk about that, what the parenting looks like, and that was, again, disrupted during boarding schools. That wasn't, these things weren't allowed to continue until we had to start reclaiming some of these traditional practices.
You're listening to the Untaming podcast.
Rewild the child.
Here is your host, Emily.
Hi, I'm Emily, and you're listening to the Untaming podcast. Today it is the new hunger moon here in the Southern Hemisphere, and this is episode 41. This is the second part of an interview our guest host Mary Francel recorded with Cammie J. Goldhammer and Kimberly Morselas on Indigenous breastfeeding. So make sure you listen to episode 40 before this one. Mary Francel will be our next 10 questions in 10 minutes participant on the first quarter of the hunger moon. And our next full episode, coinciding with the full hunger moon on the 23rd of August, is one I recorded with Ebu Robin Lim. One of our listeners recommended her as a guest, and I found it a deeply fascinating conversation on birth in Indonesia, traditional midwifery, and the effects of globalization in Asia. For now, let's continue listening to Mary, Cammie, and Kimberly.
I think I know the answer to this, but you're both based in North America. Do you know if there's anything in other parts of the world similar to this? I would assume, you know, this is pretty unique.
No.
So I mean, if some, because this is an international podcast, so if any people in communities around the world were interested in starting something like this, would they be able to reach out to you just to get a little information
yes.
about what you've
yes.
done?
Yeah.
That would be fantastic.
Yes.
Great.
Yeah.
I love that.
I mean, yeah, we feel really strongly that, like, and I've said this before, as I was like, my kitchen table is no less sacred than Linda Smith's kitchen table, which is where she wrote her 45-hour course in the IBCLC exam, right? Like, that there is nothing inherently more sacred or special about these other courses than ours. And anybody, I mean, I've always said, I'm like, we do a whole history of lactation in our training, even kind of walk through how we've gotten to where we are. And, you know, I say, like, it's all made up, right? This has all just been made up. And so, not lactation, I mean, lactation, but like, as far as the courses go, the trainings, right? We're all just making it up. And there's no reason that no one else can make up their own thing. I mean, I think, you know, especially with lactation, I think it's silly that we're an international organization like IBCLC. It just doesn't make sense to me, especially seeing how American-centric it is, you know, that there is no reason that we should be doing and determining the way things are done for LC in Cambodia, right? Like, create your own thing, do your own thing. You do not, like, nobody has to follow this plan that's been laid out for us that is not serving any of us well, right? It's not serving our communities, and we don't have to put up with it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So can you share a little bit about any particular breastfeeding or parenting practices that might be unique to specific Indigenous peoples in North America that, you know, might be help for us to understand, you know, ways that communities are able to help each other with breastfeeding and parenting?
I like to say that's one of the things that Cammie and I talk about in the very beginning of the course about children being allowed in the course. And I think that gives a good introduction of what the course is going to look like, because I feel like a lot of times when we are going to a school or a course, always like, what am I going to do with my children? And we encourage families or mothers to bring their children or their babies to breastfeed, and that there's no restriction on how they're going to parent during that time. Because I can guarantee you by day five, everybody's taking care of that baby, you know, and that's part of the kinship values that is already instilled in us as Indigenous people, is that clanship is like, we say it, didn't they? But those aunties coming in and helping, those grandmothers taking that role. And we talk about that, what the parenting looks like, and that was, again, disrupted during boarding schools. That wasn't, these things weren't allowed to continue until we had to start reclaiming some of these traditional practices. And sometimes I think we have to just be reminded, or we forget. And we really emphasize that family dynamic and that parenting in the class. And a good example was Bad River. We had a young woman that wanted to take the course, and she had a brand new baby, and her sister came to babysit, and she was just there like, don't mind me, I'm just here to watch my niece. And her sister was wanted to learn more about breastfeeding, and it was such a touching story, because at the end of day five, we do a game called Jeopardy, Breastfeeding Jeopardy, and we got to separate everybody in groups, like teams. And this auntie was so fierce in like hitting that
buzzer.
It was so funny, because she was learning so much, and she didn't realize she was going to get so much from the class. So she started coming every day, and what we found out was really pretty awesome is they were taking a bus to our class every day and leaving late every day. Just how long was the ride?
It was like
bus?
An hour and a half, they said.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they were coming every day just because how powerful this act of breastfeeding, and even their own empower to help their mothers in their community. And it was just a touching story that I remember. Cammy were just like, they ride the bus every day to our course. And she's an auntie. She didn't know she was going to be, you know,
involved. She was coming there to, like, yeah, take care of the baby. And she got a certificate at the end, because she came and she participated, and she was, you know, she was part. We were like, you're taking this course now. Like, you know, but that's, I mean, like what Kim is saying around, I mean, there's, so the way I see, you know, when we talk about lactation, you know, I've said it's a traditional practice, right? And I actually think, like, universally, it is a traditional practice that all human cultures practice traditionally, right? Many of us have lost that and no longer practice it the way our ancestors did. But universally, it is the thing that all human parents who with a uterus, like, did care for their babies after they were born. And, you know, so there's different things. Like, yes, there's different foods that we might eat, you know, that, like, here in the Pacific Northwest, like, nettle is a galactagogue. Nettle is a milk maker, right? And so that's something that we would have people drink here after their baby's born to, you know, make more milk. But it would be sold as, you know, like, you need to stay warm, you need to stay in bed, drink hot fluids, keep, you know, stay bundled up, and you need to do that for 40 days, right? Or 30 days or whatever that is, right? That's how it's sold to the person, not really recognizing that, like, oh, nettle's a milk maker, right? Like, that's what nettle does. And that you have these cultural practices that so many of our communities do that is literally there to foster lactation, right? And foster that practice. And so, yeah, so there's that. I think, you know, Kim mentioned kinship, you know, and that's something that even in the way we introduce ourselves, you know, we we say Kim says her clans, you know, because in Diné culture, they have clans. You share your relations. You share who your parents are. You share who your grandparents are, because we believe in that, you know, that's a value of many Indigenous communities, that to show you're connected, right? All my relations, you know, like that kind of stuff. And parenting was done that way too. You know, like, I think, Kim, isn't like in Diné, like, isn't your guys's word for auntie mom? Like, you call your, or like a version of mom?
Yeah, but we call it Shete. Shete is big sister.
Big sister. You know, so Shete. Yeah. Yeah, so we have different, you know, like the relation, you know, and we'll even get that, like Kim said, we let kids, we welcome kids at our training. I don't want to say let, we welcome them. We recognize that the people that take our training are often the people that the community relies on. So they are the aunties, the grandmas, the moms, you know, of everyone. And so we say, you know, bring your kids. It doesn't have to be a babe in arm or whatever. And by the end of it, you know, they're calling us auntie. You know, they'll say, because Kim and I will hold the kids while like the parent, like the participants are doing their, you know, their hands-on activity or something like that, or practicing counseling skills. And so Kim and I will be sitting on the floor, like playing with the kids and stuff like that. And like the moms are like, go see Auntie Kim, go see Auntie Cammy, you know, like that kind of stuff. Like that relationship is really important. And so when we talk about parenting from a traditional aspect, it was never done in isolation, ever. It was never meant to be, you know. And I was looking back at, you know, Mary, when you first reached out about us doing this podcast, I certainly did my due diligence, because we don't, you know, I don't want to say we're picky about who we speak to, but we do want to make sure that who we speak to is going to respect what we have to say and honor, you know, honor where we're coming from. And so I was, you know, when I was reading kind of the past podcasts and, you know, the kind of whole goal of this podcast specifically, that is an Indigenous value, right? That like the community takes care of kids. You're never meant to do anything in isolation. The way we do things, we as in kind of, you know, the general population and fairly industrialized communities, is not the way we're meant to do that, right? And when we look at communities that have maintained the tradition of breastfeeding, right, the one thing they have that other communities don't have is grandmothers that breastfed, right? They still have the same, they still worry about supply. They still get sore nipples. They still get, you know, clogs and blebs and mastitis. And, you know, like all of those things exist in all over the world, right? But they have generations of people that came before them that have been breastfeeding, right? I was the first in several generations to breastfeed. I had never seen anyone breastfeed in my life, in real life, right? When I became a parent at 28, I had never seen it before. And so for me, it was really about like reclaiming this practice for my, you know, for my family. So, you know, I'm always thankful that I didn't have major breastfeeding issues. But I always think about like, if I had, my mom couldn't have helped me. My grandma couldn't have helped me. My aunties couldn't have helped me, right? Like, what would they have? They don't know, you know, and it's not their fault. That was taken from them too.
Right.
You know,
right.
They lost that knowledge. That's what colonialism has done. Mm-hmm. But, you know, where Kim, like, grew up in a breastfeeding family, her mom, you know, she has memories of her mom breastfeeding. She was breastfed, you know, as a twin and stuff like that. And so you kind of see, like, what happens when someone grows up in that tradition and someone who doesn't, you know, and how that is.
So that's a really good – do you want to say something real quick, Kim, before I ask another question?
I was just going to say that the other side to that is I did see it growing up when I was a little girl, but when my mom breastfed my sister, she came much later. It was a short duration that she did because she became a single mother. She came from the reservation to the city life, and that was a whole different system that, you know, she had to fight through and not breastfeed very long because, you know, she had to find work in the urban setting because there was not enough work in the reservation. She became a single mom, and so she went to the WIC program. And again, that's when I started to see formula. Like, I'd never seen formula until I saw her formula feed my sister. And she did breastfeed, but she did both. And her supply didn't last very long. And when I started working for WIC, that time when I worked for WIC, it reminded me of that. Like, this is why mothers don't make enough milk. And because they don't have that support system. And now they have to, you know, come to the city to find work. And again, being a single mom, she didn't have, you know, really anybody. Like Candy said, we shouldn't be in isolation. We shouldn't be alone. We should be with people that can support us and help us.
Absolutely. And that's a really good introduction to another issue that we mentioned earlier I'd like to talk more about. And so, to the extent you feel comfortable, could you discuss the intergenerational trauma that many Indigenous people have experienced that has affected them as parents and how that may have affected their parenting? Could you discuss that? Because that's a really important topic.
Yeah. Kim, do you want to start there or do you want me to?
Oh, Kim, I think you're muted.
You muted yourself. Sorry.
Go ahead.
With what I was saying with you, Mary, just now, that just happened not too long ago with me, right, with my sister, and how that unfolded. Because my mom and dad spoke Navajo. They still speak Navajo. My mom speaks it, and my grandma doesn't know any English. But to see how things happened in their generation time, and going back to school, and that's what they say is go back to school, get education, and come back and find work and work for your people. Well, even that is not always the case because there's not enough work. And so people come back to the city and start finding jobs. And again, in my case, with my mom, she couldn't, she was a single provider and she had to do it by herself. And so she couldn't breastfeed my sister very long. And so that was more of what happened with me, with my family. But Cammy definitely has a deeper understanding she can share with what that looks like, because this is what she talks about all the time with families and the work that we do together.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, just a little, you know, I recommend folks do a deeper dive into historical trauma because there's a lot there. You know, I highly recommend Maria Yellow Horse Braveheart is one of my favorite social workers. She's Oglala Lakota social workers who does a lot of work in historical trauma, is kind of one of the foremost social workers and researchers around historical trauma. But there's just a ton of information out there now. I'm going to blank on her name. It'll come to me, but she's a Jewish woman, Rachel Yehuda, is another historical trauma researcher that just has incredible work. So start there, but kind of the brief 101 around historical trauma is the idea that we can pass trauma, and trauma is passed down from generation to generation. In many of our tribal communities, including mine, we have a belief that anything that happens to you impacts the next seven generations that come after you, right? This is why, you have a company like Seventh Generation that has co-opted an Indigenous belief and turned it into a, you know, toilet paper company. But that's the concept behind that, right? If what we do today What I say today, what we experience today is going to impact the next seven generations that come after me. And then if we think of time as not cyclical, right? So we're talking about indigenous knowledge, right? Or sorry, not linear. In indigenous knowledge, we think of time as cyclical, right? We don't just kind of have like a beginning, middle, end. It all is connected. That we are impacted by the seven generations that came before us, right? And so for many of us, I'm 40. And so and Kim's just a couple years older than me, but we are considered the seventh generation after first contact. So about 700 years, you know, since first contact. So for us to deny that we are not impacted by what occurred to our ancestors from, you know, first contact with Europeans and the genocide, you know, I mean, everything that our ancestors went through, of course that impacts us today, right? Like that's how it is. And then we have fairly significant now, which is pretty awesome, scientific evidence to support that too, right? That we do pass down trauma, other finding markers on genes, you know, that show that we are passing that down via egg or sperm, you know. So this is, you know, it's something that I think is really awesome. But, you know, of course we have, you know, science is finally catching up with indigenous knowledge. And we often say that, you know, we've always known these things. But, you know, in terms of parenting, this is a pretty significant impact, because when we think about, and Rachel Yehuda, the Jewish researcher that I was talking about, and she's an epigeneticist, like her stuff is just really incredible. And I find that even if folks are a little skeptical, you know, even if you're hearing me say like, wait, you're saying you're impacted by what happened to you, your ancestors 700 years ago, that feels like a bridge too far, right? Which I understand, like some people might have a hard time understanding that. Look up Rachel Yehuda's information, you know, stuff on Holocaust survivors and the descendants of Holocaust survivors, right? Because that is really impactful. And, you know, in large part, like while the Holocaust did not happen 700 years ago, we also, you know, we have Jewish people that have been persecuted for thousands of years at this point. And so to say things like that doesn't impact you would largely be quite offensive, right? to Jewish folks who are largely white, you know, especially in the US, white community, right? And I'm married into the other tribes. So that's, you know, my husband's Jewish and my girls identify as Judeans. They're Jewish Indians. It's a really fascinating concept. And so I highly recommend looking into it. But, you know, when we talk about parenting, because many people have different trauma responses, right? We can respond to trauma by, let's say, like me. So I'm a fairly resilient person. I'm like, my response to trauma is connection, right? Like I absolutely see, and this is why breastfeeding became such an important thing to me, is that I knew that by me connecting with my babies, by me holding my babies, by me hugging my babies and kissing my babies and feeding them from my body, that was healing, right? Like I could feel something healing in me. And I knew that it was also healing my ancestors, because that trauma had been passed down to me and was in my genes. But by me hugging and connecting to my babies, that has been shown to change those markers, right? Those trauma genes that we pass down, that is how you can change it. So of course it's healing my ancestors as well from that trauma, right? And so there's, you know, kind of that piece, but we also have, and this is probably more likely what happens when someone has a traumatic experience or many traumatic experiences, is that we will often maybe shut down, right? We will detach from those people, right? And when we think about things like breastfeeding, right, or lactation, that is a very strong connection, right? That's a very vulnerable place. By me as a Native woman saying, I am going to feed you, my daughter, from my body, only from my body, right? You're going to have no other food but from me. I was making a pretty brave promise to my child that I was going to be there for her, right? Where when we live in a community where we have an epidemic of missing and murdered Indigenous women, where we have a mortality rate, you know, the maternal mortality rate is of Indigenous women in urban areas is the highest in the country, right? That's often, you know, we have a whole other conversation about invisibility when it comes to Native people and research, but we have urban Native women have the highest maternal mortality rate in the country, right? So being able to make that commitment, right? And then if we look back at our ancestors and those that came before us, a child welfare system that disproportionately removes Native children from their Native parents, right? We have the boarding school era, which Kim mentioned, which was a 100-year government program to forcibly remove Native children from their families and send them in collaboration with the Catholic Church to Catholic boarding schools, where the sole purpose was to kill the Indian and save the man, right? We had war and famine and removal, right? All of those things were to prevent the Native family from thriving, right? And surviving. And so, and those were a threat to Native women in particular, Indigenous people who had children in particular, right? And so when I, you know, five generations later, you know, after like no one's breastfed in my family, that kind of stuff, like I was making a promise to my child that I'm yours and you're mine and I'm not going anywhere. Like it's, I can be the only one to feed you, because I'm going to be here forever for you, you know, like that kind of stuff. But when we come historical trauma, if we haven't been able to do our work, right, and like process that, prevents us from being able to do that, right? Then bottle feeding becomes a survival mechanism because of the what ifs, right? Like, and families worry about that, right? They worry about CPS coming and taking their babies. So if you go to the doctor 2 weeks after your baby's born and your baby hasn't gained the appropriate weight, right? An upper middle class white mom goes to that doctor appointment ready for help, right? Like, what do I do? You know, like that kind of stuff. She is not worried that CPS is going to get a call after she leaves that office and someone is going to show up and take her baby. Where Native people absolutely think that, right? So it is a survival mechanism often like perpetrated by our grandmas, you know, that say, fatten that baby up, right? You cannot go to a doctor and have your baby not feeding well at the breast, not gaining weight appropriately, because that is going to put us at risk for your baby being taken from us, because that has happened on every generation before us, right? And so those are the things that we need to work through, that we need to process and we need to talk about. And so when we talk about our course, this is day one, is all this. We don't even talk about clinical breastfeeding until day two. Day one is about connection, kinship, establishing those relations between that group and that trust, and talking about our history and how we've been impacted by the generations that came before us and how that continues to impact us today, because we cannot help other people breastfeed, right? If we haven't processed our own grief, our own trauma, our own experiences, right? Because it's not for those people to heal us, right? And there's a lot of lactation consultants that come into this work to heal themselves, right? And their own experience. And that's not for anyone else to do. And so that's kind of like a brief, I don't know if that's what you were looking
for. No, that was
you
know? Absolutely fabulous. I don't think a lot of people think about breastfeeding as a courageous act of like right. making that connection to a baby, because they just don't have that trauma experience of like, well, what happens if, what if? Right. And so I just, right. I think that's fantastic.
Yeah. And for people that are helping, supporting us, right, our BIPOC sisters. And trauma is not, I mean, historical trauma is not just something that like BIPOC folks own, right? We see it in Jewish communities. We see it in the GLBTQ community. There's some great research around the AIDS epidemic and like generational trauma of, you know, because a big part of intergenerational trauma or historical trauma is actually unresolved grief. That's at its core what it is, right? Because the trauma isn't actually what matters. What happens after the trauma is what matters, right? Like that's the difference. And so if we can't grieve the way we're supposed to, because we just went to a funeral last weekend and now we have another one and now, right? Talking about this pandemic, like we are going to be experiencing, this is going to be another blip on the timeline of historical trauma, right? Kim's community has experienced significant death, you know, Navajo people, elders, Diné language speakers, right? I mean, there's been all this stuff in my tribal communities. We've lost language, you know, fluent language speakers, and we will never get that back, right? Like those are things that we'll never get back. They did not get to teach what they needed to teach in the time they had. And so we're going to have, you know, I'm convinced that like in 20 years from now, like adults will be in counseling and one of the questions they will ask is like, when were you born? Yes. Winter of 2020. Interesting. Like, let's talk about that, right? Let's go back to that time period, you know?
Well, particularly with the history of, you know, white people bringing in disease into your communities. I can't imagine how much trauma that.
Absolutely. So like it's all, what I would say, you know, for folks that are, you know, again, working in communities, that you have to understand that when someone says they don't want to breastfeed, when a Native mom says she doesn't want to breastfeed, right? A lot of people go to thinking like she doesn't care about her baby. She wants to party. She wants to, you know, like whatever. You could think of a million reasons as to why, right? But no one's actually looking at the why, right? Of just like, is it because she's terrified to be taken from her child? Right. Is it because, you know, she's an incest survivor and has no idea that putting a baby to a breast is not incest, right? Is it because, like, to have a baby that's that dependent on you for everything when you don't even know that you're going to be there the next day because you're doing work that, you know, I don't know. I mean, there's just so many reasons, you know, why this goes on, but, you know, child welfare, missing and murdered Indigenous women. I mean, these are all really important things to think about, you know, and just like the context of connecting, it can be hard, right? And we've probably all had that, you know, like, I mean, I'm just, and I know Kim's super affectionate. We always talk about like our girls and how our girls get in bed with us and cuddle with us and everything like that. But that's not necessarily everyone's experience, right? We probably all we hear about families who say like, oh, affection was not my thing. Or, you know, like my mom never hugged me or they never said I love you or, you know, that kind of stuff. And then you go to breastfeed your baby. That can feel very awkward. That can feel very overwhelming if you've never been that close to someone and not had sex with them, right? Like, mm-hmm. Yeah, right. You know, in all honesty, like that's a lot,
Yeah. Kim, were you, did you want to, was there something you were going to add to that?
No, I was just going to you know, when we, again, Cammie mentioned the first day of our course, and she said that we spent a lot of time on historical trauma. When we did Hawaii, their history was different from ours, but not. And a lot of them just didn't know. And they were going through something similar for to their homelands. And just to see that connection from, you know, us and them, it just made the understanding of how we all come from that trauma and how we are able to receive it and heal our communities. But that was all day one, and we spent a lot of time on it. And day two, it's a little heavy coming in, but they tend to really bring in their vulnerability and their openness, and they share a lot that first, second day. And then we go into the other parts of the work. But that really ties into a lot of things that they felt or experiencing with breastfeeding. And it just really makes sense to them at the end. They may not get all the answers, but some of them never ever thought about why they didn't breastfeed long or why their parents didn't breastfeed their mother. And I think they go back and ask questions to their families, and that's important. It's an important part of their journey.
So this is probably just like a white woman kind of, you know, inferring something. But it almost feels like the way sometimes in rituals you clear the energy through sage or through anything like that. You're kind of clearing the space before you try to deal with anything, you know, try to bring in anything else. Okay, because that just really feels like that's such an important part of what you're doing that has to be addressed first.
Absolutely.
Since you brought up the LGBTQ community, I just wanted to also mention, I wanted to ask you about the role of Two-Spirit people in parenting and breastfeeding, and if you might want to talk a little bit about that, you know, before we go on to anything else.
Yeah, well, our Two-Spirit relatives are, traditionally completely integrated into our society and our communities and play in a very important role in many of our communities. There's lots and lots, hundreds of different tribes in the United States. So we certainly can't speak to, you know, say all tribes do, you know, practice this or that. But we know that many of our tribes did not have, you know, the binary, like gender identity, and so our Two-Spirit community members, which often refers to folks that may identify as, you know, gay or lesbian, bisexual, but also may have they're on the spectrum of, you know, as far as gender identity goes. So Two-Spirit kind of can encompass everybody in that group. And so, we have many Two-Spirit parents. We have many Two-Spirit breastfeeders and chest feeders. And we certainly, you know, I think, again, traditionally play a really important role in our communities. A lot of times we believe in balance is an important part and often an Indigenous value. And so our Two-Spirit relatives oftentimes bring that for us and offer that, you know, except for in one person, which is a gift and to be honored, you know. So there's a lot there. We've definitely, you know, I think when we had one participant at our New Mexico training that was this, you know, we do a closing circle and she identifies as Two-Spirit. And one of the things that I remember her saying after the end, you know, the end of our training was, prior to coming to the training, she didn't see parenting as something that was for her to do. You know, she didn't, and she was a fierce auntie and just, you know, played a huge role in her niece's life, literally left the city to go home. Her and her sister left their jobs, left in Phoenix and moved home to the reservation to help raise their niece with their sister, you know, who had delivered the baby. And And she had said, like, she didn't think that parenting was for her, but after taking the course and learning everything, she realized that she'd be an awesome parent, you know, and that it is for her. We definitely, have a lot of, you know, still have a lot of work to do in our communities, but Kim can share some experiences too, especially as the mom of two spirit kids.
Yeah, I do. My two daughters talk about parenting. My oldest, she thinks about one day she wants to be a parent, but she wants to adopt. And she talks about how that's going to look like. And she wants to adopt Native children. And she doesn't want to do any birthing. but she did say she was interested in breastfeeding. So that I found that very fascinating, because we talk about that, what that looks like. And some people refer to it as chest feeding. And so we have that conversation, and they talk about how they would do that, you know, how her and her partner would do that, how they can share that experience without her birthing the baby. And then my middle daughter also is two-spirited, and she says she's going to have the baby and breastfeed. So it's interesting to hear their perceptions on that, and that they're not ashamed of it, because we talk about it so often in our community. They belong to an inner tribal youth council here in Arizona that my family were a part of, and that was where they felt more comfortable, because we had two-spirited youth in the group. And so they knew that two-spirited were very special people. And even the language that they would even teach me how to be appropriate with my language. so I'm learning too, but I've encountered patients that, you know, shared parenting, that wanted to breastfeed, chest feeding, SNS, you know. Some of the staff thought it was pretty awkward where I work, even just the word chest feeding or body feeding. So I explained to them what that looked like and why we use language, and it's very important to be inclusive and not exclude, the community out that have these types of lifestyles. And so it's been interesting, and also, again, learning from my daughters and their relationships, and that, I would like grandchildren one day, but I just feel like I'm blessed to have them and hear what their perspectives are when it comes to birth and breastfeeding, and that they're both different, but they still want to share that bond with their children.
Yeah, and that acceptance within your community of this difference is just so wonderful, that there's, you know, with all the other differences that people have to deal with and all the other discrimination and trauma, that's one place where they can feel safe. So that's wonderful.
Yeah, hopefully. We hope that, right? But we also have been quite impacted by colonialism. And I think if we spoke to many two-spirit relatives, that they would absolutely say they don't feel safe in our community, because largely in the Native community, it is overwhelmingly Christian, overwhelmingly Catholic. You know, this is what colonialism did.
Exactly.
And stuff. And so it's, you know, this is all part of decolonization, right? And that it's an important piece of it, and inclusivity is an important piece of it, but we see it as, you know, the mainstream word is talking about it as inclusive, but I see it as decolonizing, right? That, like, mm-hmm. when we fully accept our two-spirit relatives in every way, that is decolonization, right? Like, that, then we will, you know, that will be a key part of achieving decolonization, right? Which I think will be a lifelong endeavor for generations and generations. You know, you can never undo it, right? Like, we can't undo it, but there's a lot we can do to heal from that. you know, so.
Absolutely. Another yeah. trauma that is, it was inflicted and needs to
absolutely
be healed. Yeah. So we've gone, had a wonderful long conversation. So I'm actually wanting to kind of skip ahead and just ask if you can share how Indigenous parents in North America can find resources to help them on their parenting journey. Like, for example, where would they find out if someone who's taken your program is available in their community, or what are some things that they should be aware of?
Oh my gosh. Yes. This is where areas that we can certainly improve on. I'm like, I would love to have a directory of Indigenous breastfeeding counselors someday. But there's some awesome resources. I mean, different tribal communities have different programs. And so I highly recommend starting with your own tribal community and seeing, you know, if they have a home visiting program, or, you know, of course, WIC or something like that for those that are in the United States. Definitely, you know, social media is a great place to go. So, you know, I know we didn't get a chance to go over it, but Native Breastfeeding Week is, you know, a pretty big event. Last year was our second year, which was awesome. And so go to Native Breastfeeding Week on Facebook and Instagram, and there's a ton of information there and resources. Kim and I also are super, I mean, for Native parents, like, reach out to us. We're happy to support you or put you in touch with an IBC in your area if you need some, you know, support that way. We do a pretty good job of remembering everyone. We have a Facebook group for IBCs, and so we'll often post on there. Like, I had a friend reach out to me a couple months ago for her sister who is somewhere in Minnesota, and I was like, who's near this tribal community, you know? And someone was like, I am, I'll drive there, it's only 90 minutes away. And I'm like, what? I was like, this is where oh, I was like, okay, got it. You know, and so they were able to, two of our Indigenous breastfeeding counselors were able to go and help that mom, you know, in that time. And Kim gets a ton of questions from folks as well. And then we have more and more Indigenous lactation consultants, doula programs here in Seattle. I run Daybreak Star Doulas, which is a doula program that supports Native pregnant people that are Native American, Alaska Native, Pacific Islander, Native Hawaiian. Navajo Nation Breastfeeding Coalition.
New Mexico Breastfeeding Task Force.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I reach out to local coalitions.
Yeah, we'll put all of those in the show notes. If you send me all of those links, we'll definitely.
Absolutely. Yeah. That. And then there's some great Facebook groups, you know, Indigenous Motherhood, you know, is a pretty active group, and there's a lot there. So, you know, for folks that feel comfortable going there, please go there. But yeah, there's, you know, we're, you know, to quote Hamilton, like, this is like quite the time to be alive. You know, like, I just think, like, as Indigenous birth workers, like, it's so exciting. Kim and I have been at this for a long time individually, you know, over 10 years. And when it was, you know, at that time, like, literally I could see Kim at a conference and be like, there's another Native person, right? There's one other Native person. Now we could have our own conference. We have our own train, you know, that's just so exciting to see this reclaiming of this knowledge, you know, and that's what we think of, like, when it comes to lactation, birth, parenting is, you know, it is a traditional practice, and it's about reclaiming that as our own, and in our own way, right? Like, doing it the way we do it, and that the way we do it is awesome, you know? So
absolutely.
Yeah, I think also too is including the fathers, like, you know, we are seeing more fatherhood programs surrounding this discussion and what they can do to be involved and how positive it can be and not have a stigma that's negative, you know, when it comes to fathers and how we can heal. And we have friends that have their partners doing different work too, and fostering that relationship with fatherhood. So I think we're just reclaiming our whole family dynamic, and it's just been really good work, and I think it's healing for everybody.
That's so beautiful. Is there anything else you would like to add? We've covered so much, but I want to make sure you get a chance to, you know, say anything else that you think would be helpful to folks out there.
I'm good. I think I talked enough.
Kim, anything to add?
I'll let Kim have the closing words. Thank you, everyone.
Oh, my goodness. I even love hearing Cammy speak because it just reminds me to, you know, just continue to be inspired by the work and what we do, and that just reclaiming and being that form of resistance for our Native communities. And I'm looking for more mentees, more people I can help mentor, because, you know, it's just, for the most part, it's mostly me and Cammy, but we love to see upcoming IBCLCs should they choose to go that pathway. But, you know, just we're pretty accessible. People will reach out to both of us at the same time. And sometimes we'll do virtual consults together or phone calls or, you know, I know we've done hum visits together where we're in the same state. So that's been really helpful. But yeah, this work has been amazing and it's taught me so much. I learn a lot from Cammy, and every time we go on our long trips and, you know, we just share and talk and look forward to the next community we're going to see and how much we're going to learn from them. So really we learn a lot from the community than what I feel like we give out. So it's been amazing, amazing journey. And I can't wait to get out there and see more of our Indigenous sisters and brothers.
Yes. Well, wear your mask.
Yeah, I'm really hoping everyone wears their masks and gets vaccinated so that you can get out in the field again.
Yes, please, please do. Yes, we're getting so close, everyone.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Cammy J. Goldhammer and Kimberly Moore Salas, the people who have just started this wonderful Indigenous breastfeeding counselor program, and you're just doing such tremendous work in your communities, and we appreciate it so much. So thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you, Mary. Thank you everyone for listening.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.